stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with the very difficult to categorize Annie Morrison. Annie Morrison, who is an actor, a dancer, a singer, a playwright, a storyteller, a philanthropist, and a self-described Celtic goddess. Annie Morrison, if it has to do with creativity, she can do it. So stay tuned. This is a charming, charming ride. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down
about being the person you really are. Not the person you think you're supposed to be. Not even the person you may be acting as though you are. Certainly not the person others told you you needed to be, or the person you think other people are and therefore you need to be too, but the person you really are. In my shows, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, and I do this because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And it is my hope that that will inspire you to ask yourself, am I being who I really am? In this show, I am airing an interview I did with Annie Morrison, who is the poster child for being who you really are. And in the first half of the interview, Annie will talk about her early life and her family. And you will hear what I believe to be the most important factor in our becoming who we really are. And that is in the support, encouragement, and nourishing of the family, which Annie definitely had. And then you will hear Annie talking about her current work, which is part of the ensemble Sondheim on Sondheim, which is currently at Free Fall Theater in St. Petersburg, Florida. Before I play the first part of Annie's interview, I need to alert you to the fact that there were wind chimes, which I didn't realize my equipment was picking up quite so loudly. So that's not happening in your house. That's happening on my show.
So now I'm going to let you listen to the irrepressible, the very much herself, Annie Morrison.
Okay, I'm here with Annie Morrison in her adorable little house in Sarasota. And I have not yet explained to her that any interview artists who are making their living or their life with their work, with their art, which you clearly do. So,
Of course, I'm poor, but
so many.
But I'm happy.
Yes. Well, so I mean, that's the challenge of having been captured by an art.
That's right.
You know, quite often that is.
And I love that you say captured, because that's what it feels like.
That's right. What I want to talk to. The thrust of the interviews that I do with artists have to do with how they became who they are. So do you mind talking about how it found you, or how you found it, or how?
Well, I was blessed and lucky, I feel like I was blessed, to be brought up in a family that were theater people.
Uh-huh.
But they were theater people on a college level. My father was a wonderful music professor. Funny man. He was a combination of, as a teacher, of Danny Kaye and Victor Borga.
Oh my
God. So he's hilarious. Just hilarious. And to this day, he has students that contact me because he meant so much to them. And not only was he a great teacher, but he was just a wonderful storyteller and a wonderful musician. Piano was his specialty, and very highly creative. My mother was a modern dancer, so she taught movement in the theater, modern dance. She was a director. She was a visual artist. Everything you see on the walls here, by the way, had beautiful artwork from my mother on the walls. She's trained at the Chicago Art Institute, so my house is really kind of a shrine to both their art, her visual art, and all his music over here.
Wow.
And they collaborated. They were wonderful collaborators. They wrote 3 ballets, 1 opera, 3 musicals.
Wow, a marriage made in heaven.
Oh, yes. So I grew up believing that theater or art was all about collaboration and cooperation. And that I thought that that's what the world was about, and that's what life was about.
Ah, surprise.
Surprise. So when I, and I had an excellent training, in the school system, you know, it happened to be a magnificent high school that wasn't a performing arts high school, but it could have been.
Where were you?
I was living, at that time I was in high school, I was in Lombard, Illinois. We were outside of Chicago because of the college that my dad was now teaching at. And my mom was, you know, this was the 50s, 40s, 50s. Moms, the wives kind of just went along with the husbands and were teaching at a hell of a lot cheaper than anything else. But they were happy, you know, and it was art everywhere. So my sister came home from college one day, and she was in a communications course, and her project was to change one art form into something else or whatever, but some sort of communication. So she wrote a poem based on a piece of sculpture that she liked in the house that we had, and then presented to the rest of the family to find another way to express that poem. So my dad wrote a song for it, my brother did photography because he was a photographer, my mom created a dance that we videotaped with me dancing it, then my dad wrote another song, then I sang the song. I mean, it was just this huge, that's what we did all the time.
Oh my God.
Sometimes my folks were invited to go to different churches, and my mom and my sister and I would do liturgical dances to readings that my dad would read. I mean, it was just like, that's all we did all the time.
Yeah.
So growing up was great.
Yeah.
And then I went out into the world to study, and I didn't want to go to college. I got there, and I had done my college all my life.
Yes.
So I didn't want
to. You were
that.
Trained, right?
Right. And being dyslexic, being in a formal education was just painful. I just went out and just did it, is what I ended up doing. And I don't regret that one bit. Of course, now, you know, now that I'm in my I'm going to be 53, everyone. it would be nice probably to have a degree in something, but why it would have been in theater, and what nowadays that wouldn't be anything. It wouldn't mean anything, especially
right.
nowadays. So I'm glad I didn't do that route. I just went and did it. So it was, this new word came up. It was called competition. Uh-huh. And that was never part of my paradigm, ever, and still isn't. I have a real hard time in the world because of that. One of the reasons why I'm not in New York anymore is that that's not art to me.
To the extent that you can, just give me the chronology. You know, so you went into the world. Where did you go?
Okay, I went to the Boston Conservatory of Music to start off, and that's what I left because it started a new musical theater department, and it was just not ready yet for me. I went off and had much better training, or enjoyed much more, when I went to New York and went to the Herbert Berghoff Studios.
Uh-huh.
Because the people in your classroom are other students,
mm-hmm.
And they're already working. People who are doing shows just want to work on their crafts.
Okay, so in this context, you felt comfortable and at home.
Oh, I was at home,
right.
Totally.
Right.
Then I went off and joined a Korean family, because I fell in love with the second eldest son, and did nightclubs for about 2 years, which was other incredible training because it taught me to be able to break the fourth wall, directly with audiences in a way that a lot of actors do not have the courage to do at all.
No.
And developed another understanding about the cabaret thing that I liked anyway, because I used to do it with my dad was so cute. He would take me into Chicago and I would dress with little 40s hats on and I pretend he was my sugar daddy and we would go listen to jazz, you know, speakeasies. He was so much fun. But and then we did a club act together, my dad and I.
Oh, my God.
You know, when I was very, very young. I mean, like, you know, when I was 18, you know, 18, 19. So I came down, I decided I needed to break away from that, get back into the theater, and I had the great privilege of coming down and working for a year at the Oslo in 78, during their children's tour at the time. Loved it, and that's what got me to Sarasota in the future.
Uh-huh.
Because a couple of years later, I wanted my folks to retire. If they had to retire in Florida to take care of the grandmother, why not Sarasota? Had all this art, it would be a perfect place for them. And they did, and they moved them in right away. So, that. I went over, then the next year, over to the Burt Reynolds Jupiter Theater, which was their very first year. In fact, all the sandbags Miss Morrison filled in the parking lot. You know, and drugged them into the theater, you know. So I was there at the very, very beginning in the guinea pig program for that, which no longer exists, which is a shame. But got a chance to see TV stars, stage stars, and film stars work.
Trooping through it.
Oh, my goodness, right. You know. And that was another reason why I didn't think I ever wanted to do television. Because they just seem like a miserable lot of people. Making money, but not happy people. and the film people that I admired were the film people that claimed theater was everything. They'd give anything to go back and do stage work because that's their love.
Right.
You know, there's nothing like it, being in front of a live audience. So that was fine. And then I had met Moses Goldberg, this amazing man who taught this form of children's theater that I like to teach periodically. But he said to me, "Where'd you get that scar on your chin?" And I said, and I'd completely forgotten. In 13, I was in a terrible car accident. I went to the white light. I did the whole bit.
Oh, my.
And you're never the same when you do that. You're just, I'm not afraid of death.
Can you talk just a little bit
about
that?
Oh, I will a lot about because it informed the rest of my life. I went through the windshield and the dashboard and fell underneath the well of the car, and the car crushed on top of me. It's one of those freak accidents. If I had my seatbelt on, we wouldn't be talking today. So I am.
You mean because you got out of the car?
No, they had to dig me out of the car. They had to give the jaws of life to pull me out of the car. But the car crushed on top of me. I was protected in this little well.
Oh, my God.
I would have been completely crushed. Right. So, it's just goofy. And so this day, I'm very hesitant about putting my seatbelt on. I know it keeps me safe, but I always...
In some context, but yeah,
I always feel about that little...
Right.
I'll be trapped. And I go, no, you won't be trapped. That was that time. That will never happen again. So that put me on a very different spiritual path.
Yeah. Very young.
Very young. I'm a druid. And I've been a druid for a very long time. Sometimes I left it to explore more nature-based things. I became involved with the Native American traditions. And finally a Native American said, "Well, you're a Celt, Annie. Go back to it's the same thing. Well, all the indigenous people of the world speak the same language. But you keep talking about the
Celts." So now are you...
Because I saw them when I was little.
I believe you. So are you a Celt by birth?
I'm a Celt by birth, yeah. I'm mostly Scottish.
Are you a Scot? Right, I was just going to say, right,
Scottish.
Of course.
My Morrison, my mother was a Walker.
Of course.
In fact, when they both passed away, I took a large chunk of their ashes to Scotland.
Where?
To the Isle of Skye in a fairy glen. I left them in a fairy glen.
Of course you did.
Of course. And they wrote this beautiful art song called Enchantments, which is the voice of a fairy singing about being in the Black Mountains of Scotland. So, of course, I had to take them. I just came back about a couple years ago from doing that ceremony, and that informed me some more stuff. But, so that spiritual path is very, very strong in me. And when I went off, left the Burt Reynolds, I went right to New York with my equity card. I got into my first show immediately was an off-Broadway show called Dreamtime, which was a reworking of a script by Alfred Urey, which I later worked again just a couple years ago, and Robert Waldman. It was a show called Swing, and it didn't do very well, so they did a reworking of it for three characters, which led me right into my first regional thing up in Rochester, New York, which where the people saw me informed the people from Merrily to Roll Along, my first Broadway show. So it was a bing, bing, bing. It was was like unbelievable. And although Merrily was a failed musical historically, it's this huge cult. So bizarre. I can walk into the theater communities and people, and more so, oh my God.
I listen to you in my iPod every morning.
It's like, you know, would you sign my Merrily album? It's so weird, you know. And then this rest of the world, I don't have a clue who I am, you know. But there's this pocket of people like, I'm a goddess. No, I'm a druid priestess. So anyway, so that was that didn't hurt my career, although it damaged so much of us in many, many ways, which the damaging, kind of like, there was soul loss. You know, I had to go back and retrieve my soul.
Because?
Because we were so damaged emotionally. Everybody, even Stephen Sondheim was damaged emotionally.
Because it was failed?
It failed in such a horrific way. I mean, I was working with musical theater gods. They can't hurt us.
Yeah.
And we were all young and new. I mean, Jason Alexander made his Broadway debut with me, you know. And luckily, his damage wasn't too bad. He went off into television. Bless his heart. So anyway, I went off and I just did all these wonderful off-Broadway shows. I went off and starred in the West End in London in a show called Peg. It's a musical version of Peg My Heart. They idolized me there because they think American musical theater people just don't do it the way they do it there. Yeah. You know, lovely time. I had gotten married between that. So when I came back from London, I came back pregnant with my son Huckleberry, named him Huckleberry Walton, because I couldn't have a John or a Jeff. You know. Came back to New York and did Goblin Market. I noticed that the things that I was auditioning for were now going to people with television credits. I could see the writing on the wall in the 80s. And I wasn't going to work in the theater if I didn't have television. Now, I don't like television. I don't like to watch it. So here I go off to L.A., and it was devastating for me. And I was also fighting the wounding that I got about having the scar on my chin, that I'd never be able to do television and film. And so when you're 20, you believe that stuff. So I think I always had that look in my eye that you can't hire me, so I never got hired. Just a few things. And I didn't like the TV world. You know, they were unhappy people. But I met these incredible people because I was working with the New Age community at the time in working on things that didn't feel right to me. We had Marianne Williamson and Louise L. Hay, the big voices of the community, saying stuff like, the opposite of love is fear. And I said, that's the most unloving statement I ever heard. How does fear ever get the healing it deserves when that judgment attached to it? And so I thought, I can't. I don't fit here. There's something else I need to discover. And found this most amazing group of people. And we worked in intense emotional healing work. Intense. Was pulling in as much loving light as we possibly could in these places. Like soul retrieval in a very intense way. So, I became an emotional healer. I open up space for you to be completely safe, to move through anything you want to that feels like mostly the things you've denied feeling. Because you've deemed them unacceptable or unloving. And so you have pieces of yourself that are out there that need to come home and be parented because they have things to teach you and inform you about why you're here and we don't listen anymore. So my job is to keep you safe and know that you're loved and those things aren't going to hurt you. So it's profound and I don't get a lot of people doing it because it's still so scary. It's a scary place for people. But the people I've worked with always come back. So that's what L.A. was about. My son said, Mommy, why is it when people say what they're going to be when they grow up, they never are? And I went, oh. And I said, that's it. I have to prove to my son and myself, I still cry when I think about this, that you can be what you want to be when you grow up. So I spent two days in meditation to figure out what it was I wanted to be, which was always about doing theater.
Yes.
But it was about doing theater with a purpose. I don't have to be a Broadway star. I don't have to be a movie star. For me, success is making sure that theater has a purpose. And so I moved to Sarasota. Sarasota was the perfect place for me. It was so nurturing. I had my folks next door to help me with Huck so I could go off and do things if I had to. It was just amazing. This community gave me a chance to do one people shows, explore all these amazing things. I will always be loving to Sarasota. It was a great community for me. So I've written many one-people shows. I have a one-woman show called Discourse of a Maid, which is based on Celtic mythology and storytelling. And the idea is I'll tell a Celtic myth, and I like it based on Joseph Campbell, which my mother brought me up on. That was her religion, was Joseph Campbell. And so you know, it's time to create a new mythology. Mm-hmm. So that's what the whole show's about. We'll look at an old Celtic myth because it's something people aren't used to.
Right.
Let's look at something it's not familiar with. How did that inform me so I tell my own myth in present time? And at the end of the three cycles, I'll tell three cycles of something. Ygrail is my dream weaver. She is the voice of my future. And she weaves the message that was learned, the metaphor from all those things, and speaks the voice of the future. You know, so that's the purpose. Now I'm in the process of writing the second cycle. There'll be three cycles. It'll be a trilogy. And that's the movement of a Modron. Modron is a Celtic Welsh name for a mother goddess. So it's maiden, mother, and the third cycle will be crone. So it'll be Song of the Caillach. The Caillach is the crone stage of what we go through. And I would like to get some funding. I wish I could get like a grant or something to finish it because it's so much work to do. And there are people I want to study with. I want to go back to one of my emotional healer teachers to do some profound work in a deeper level, just she and I, that will become a theater piece. So that it becomes something for the audience as well. I've got this idea in my head to make this a theatrical piece that involves the audience where they're safe. But I want to develop it. So I've got to find a way to find the money.
Where did you do the first one?
I did it here in Sarasota. I've done it in some colleges. Love to do it in colleges because students...
Yeah, they're really open.
Eat it up. And then I go into the classrooms. You know, I can go into theater classrooms. I can go into... theology. I went to a theology classroom. That was intense. Because the joke is, or the fun is, I have to give you a crash course on Druidry so you understand why
you're talking about.
The bard for your
right.
day.
Why
it's important to do the storytelling in that way. Because from an old Celtic tradition. And eat it up. Or literature students, or mythology students, or folklore students, or, you know, all those kinds. Psych students want to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
Philosophy students, I mean, because I talk about Joseph Campbell, I mean, just all kinds of things spin off from it. So it's, you know, let's go for it. And then I wrote another one-woman show called Annie's Celtic Kitchen. And I come to your home and I cook your meal. It's all out of my Celtic folklore cookbook. And then I sing songs and tell stories and proverbs all based on the foods that you're eating. And then you're invited back to your living room and I sing other songs that aren't food related. But in this economy, that idea just tanked. I mean, no, that's just too much money for people to shell out. So that's fine. Because they have to pay for the meal. I ain't paying for it. But it's so much fun to do. It's just delightful. And now the one I'm writing now, and I've done a couple times, is while sitting in a fairy glen. And the it's another living room theater because people are not going out, so I'll come to you. And I just don't know how to market it yet. But I come to your living room, and you can have, like, there's house concerts are being very popular right
mm-hmm.
now. It's the same thing, you're just having something theatrical
right.
instead of just listening to a guitarist.
Right.
And the first section is I tell why it's called Sitting in the Fairy Glen, and I tell the story of going to Scotland with my parents' ashes.
Right.
And it's very funny about how I met the Scottish investment banker and how he told me how to get to the glen and the experience of the glen and what happened in the glen and loss of time in the glen and this information of this first story that I wrote because I also wanted to visit a girl. I'm a fairy godmother to several children on the internet. And this little girl is, I bet, because she's Scottish and she has leukemia.
Mm.
And I'm her woman in gold and green. That's what she knows in the ads. And I send her stories and what have you. So while I was in the glen, I realized, and her mother didn't want me to see her because she was kind of ill. And I realized, Annie, you can't go see her. That'll ruin the image. She has this image of what the world
right.
of gold and green looks like. Oh, you dummy. So the fairies were informing me in the glen while I was in meditation. This idea of a story for her. So I wrote it. It's called Amy and the Zymox. And I sent it to her and realized that I was writing a series of fairy tales because I had some other kids, you know, kids I work with, that aren't fairy tales for children. They're fairy tales for the caregivers. So the story is really for Amy's mother. And she's given me permission to perform it and give it to other people, you know. So that's why I like to do it. The next one is for this boy, Trevor Spire, who's been labeled with ADHD, and his mother, it's really for her. But she loves it. She wants me to go do it in, you know, places where kids are struggling with that labeling. And she always writes me back, oh, I'm in Trevor's fire right now. Trevor's informing me this, you know. The idea is that people who have afflicted with something or whatever, we always think that it's a disease and something horrible. But maybe there's something magical about why they're going through that. And that's what the story is about. The other thing about Sarasota is I created two theater companies, which I'm very proud of. One of them is Kaleidoscope, which I married the Oslo State Theater and the human resource organization called Community Haven for Adults and Children. And it's theater for persons with developmental disabilities. So I have all these new friends. They're Down syndrome, Williams syndrome, brain injuries, which I understand because I had a brain injury, you know. And I love them. They're my peeps. I just had dialogue with, I'm going back to Kaleidoscope this summer to be the director and artistic director for the program.
Right.
And I'm very excited. And they're all excited to be coming back, you know. And the other company was also working with that population, but helping them, all their words, them write their own theater pieces. Linda Blum wrote a musical, 10 Minutes, Adorable. Tim wrote a population wrote a play. Susie Getz, who has Williams Syndrome, wrote an opera. It's hilarious. And we just lost her. She was my first cast member I lost. She just passed away.
Oh, my.
Of pancreatic and liver cancer. I can't believe it. I can't believe my little girl's gone. But anyway.
It's all right. It's all right. Take your time.
Yeah.
Take your time.
So it's just profound. So we're gonna honor Linda Blum this summer by taking her play, because their plays are then performed by professional actors, and they have to work with professional people. In the community. So they will have to work with these professional people, and I told the professional actors, this is probably going to affect your life. You'll never be the same for this. And because of it. It was. They could talk to them. They couldn't talk to me. I said, if you have a question about why they wrote a line that way, ask them directly, because this population is learning to communicate, and you're helping them by asking questions.
Right.
And they may not be able to answer it for you.
And anyway, they have the answers.
Right. Yeah.
Whether they can answer it or not, they're
right.
The ones who know.
They know, yeah.
Right.
And it may be
and
simple.
That itself is so, must be so empowering to them that they are the ones who know.
Yeah.
Because they're so used to being helped, being at the mercy of other people knowing.
Exactly.
You know?
And you know what, so how everything in your life informs you about something else.
Yes.
These people, especially persons with Down syndrome, are so connected to their moment to moment, and their now, and they're happy. They're always in a state of happy, and yet they feel everything because they don't hold anything. So they're angry. Oh, let's go play now.
And so it's going right through them.
Healthy,
right?
It's healthy,
right.
healthy,
right.
Because they feel it at the moment.
Right, it's going right
and
through informed.
Them. They're like, I'm angry now. Okay, that's what that was. Okay, all right. Okay, oh, let's go play again.
Yeah, right.
You know, so or they're they're really sad about something, and then. Can we go do something? Yeah, let's go do it. And then they're off again. That's healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So you learn a lot from them.
So talk to me about Sondheim on Sondheim.
Yeah, here's a little bit of the history of it. The a man by the name of David Kernan, who created Side-by-Side by Sondheim many, many years ago, like, what was it, 1980s, 90s, right around there. It was very successful. Put another review called Moving On. And he interviewed Stephen Sondheim. It was an audio interview. And then he would have different performers. It was three women and two men perform pieces that basically things that Sondheim was talking about. And then the audience would hear his voice, and they would see a series of slides and pictures behind it. And then the performers would make things come to life. And that was successful. And Sondheim really liked it, and he enjoyed doing that interview. And David brought that to the United States around 2001, right after 9/11. So it was a little traumatic time, and he took it to Laguna Beach Playhouse in California, which had to be my brother-in-law's, he was the artistic director of. And David Kernan asked to have me, since he knew I was in Merrily, the original Merrily Roll-Along, to audition. So we had to wait a while because planes were grounded, mm-hmm. but we could finally get back up in the air, went out there, and I had a wonderful time. And we did it. It was a couple things were changed from the London production, but it's basically Terry Ralston, who was originally in Company mm-hmm. of Sondheim's and in Little Night Music and various other things. Michael Angle, a wonderful performer. I've known forever, doing Forever Plaid, and he's a wonderful little hoofer. Christopher Crothers, I don't know if you would know, very well known in the California area, and Tammy Tampin. And myself. So it was three women and the two men again. And I didn't come to see it, but he got videos of it. He really enjoyed it. And then nothing sort of kind of happened. I mean, I think he was dicking around with it. And it wasn't until Lapine got a hold of the material and decided for his 80th birthday to do another one. So he, instead of doing the audio, removed all that and did a visual video interview with Steve and got even more intimate with him. Got him to be very, very intimate about his life. Talking more in depth about his relationship with his mother. It was just really, really fun. And because of that, the songs had to change. A lot of material had to change. He would rip things that were part trios and duos from before, because now the storytelling shifted. He could put them in different positions and get rid of some things and highlight other material. Oftentimes people say, well, why didn't they sing Here's a Lazy Lunch, or this, that, and the other thing? Why is there nothing really from Pacific Overtures? Because the storytelling that Lapine got out of Steve didn't really warrant that to be there. Mm-hmm. So that's what it was. So that's how it became Sondheim on Sondheim. But originally had a history before that, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, my God. Okay, and so you've done this before, haven't you?
I've never done this production, no.
Oh.
No, I've never done that. Only Moving On is the only thing I've done. But not this production. Originally it starred Barbara Cook, Tom Wilpat, and Vanessa Williams. Mm-hmm. The cast now stretched from 5 players to 8, so there's 4 women and 4 men. 4 younger people, counterparts to the 4 older generation. I'm taking the Barbara Cook track, pretty much, although because it says that we can do whatever we want to, depending on our personalities, things got moved around. For instance, I originated a show in Merrily Roll Along. There's a song called Now You Know. We can talk about that later. And they said, well, it'll just be ridiculous to have you in this company. You don't sing the song. So that was never a part of Barbara Cook's track, but it is now. And a couple of the things got shifted around. Better for the personality of the 8 people that we have, which is a wonderful group, a wonderful company.
Talk about Now You Know.
Okay. My story, mm-hmm. The way I see it, when Merrily was cast, they cast everybody.
Say a little thing. Talk about Merrily and the history of Merrily, because everybody doesn't know.
Oh, great. Everybody doesn't know. And you're not my friend.
Yes, but now they'll know.
And now they'll know.
Right.
Merrily, We Roll Along was originally a play in 1933. It was a Kaufman and Hart play. It did fairly well. I've talked to Ann Kaufman, his daughter, who now owns the property of that. She's in her 90s now. She's a dear. But it did fairly well. But it was a very difficult piece because it had a lot of characters and the story went backwards, looking at a man and his relationships. And if we go backwards, maybe we can see why he made the decisions he made in his life that may have not been, maybe not pan out too well. but it was quite a lovely idea. And Judy Prince, Hal Prince's wife, Hal Prince, who is the Prince of Broadway, King of Broadway, with thousands of, like, 21 Tony Awards, and a great companion, a working companionship with Stephen Sondheim. They had done Company together, they had done Sweeney Todd, Follies, Pacific Overtures, just a numerous amount of beautiful pieces of theater. And they even had a relationship before when Prince was pretty much primarily a producer. He was on board with producing a West Side Story, for instance. So, and Gypsy. So they had quite a connection. And Judy Prince thought, wouldn't it be great if we could do a show that really enjoyed that raw, fun talent that you see when you go to see an amazing high school production. And so I thought, well, why don't we do it with a bunch of kids? They were hoping to have a cast of 16, 17, 8-year-old, maybe 19, maybe 20 is the oldest. Mm-hmm. And they thought it'd be a fun idea. So why don't we take Merrily Roll Along and restructure it, bring it up to date so it started in 1981 and go back to 56 with Sputnik. And they brought George Firth on board to write the book. Mm-hmm. And they'd known each other from doing Company, for instance. So it looked like this was going to be a great fit. They brought in Ron Field to be the choreographer. Ron had worked many times with Prince, for example, Cabaret. And so this is a great, these were the gods of musical theater at the time. Right. So couldn't be better, right? Mm-hmm. But they cast everybody in the show except their female lead, a character by the name of Mary Flynn. The 3 leads were Franklin Shepard, Charlie Kringus and Mary Flynn, and the assortment of other people that told the story going backwards. Well, they had everybody, and Hal, except for Mary Flynn, And Hal said, let's delay the first rehearsals for several reasons. A, gives us more time to find the Mary Flynn that we want to have to fit the people that we have. And I don't want to go into rehearsals with you, Steve, without the score finished. Because I know you'd like to do this, but we're not going to have that happen this time. Gives you time to finish it. Which, by the way, at first day of rehearsal, everything was in except for one number, and that was Franklin Shepard, Inc. And if you've ever seen Merrily Row Along, that's a whole other story in itself. But anyway, someone who sort of submitted me. I was going to be turning 25 that year, and so I was already considered over the hill for that particular production. And so I just didn't think anything of it. I went up to Jiva Theater in New York, a wonderful repertory theater up in upstate New York, doing a new play, a new musical called Keystone, another version of a Mac and Mabel story. And the producers, the casting people on that thought, I think that's the Mary Flynn that they're looking for, and made a notice of that. And they said, I think we've already seen her. I said, no, you haven't seen her. So they sent Ron Field up to take a look. And Ron Field said, ooh, that's the Mary Flynn.
Wow.
So he saw me afterwards and he said, I'm going to give you some pointers. I know that we're going to have you come down and audition for Hal Prince. And here's some things to think about. I don't remember what he said, but get it. Now, in those days, you used to audition on Broadway stages. So, when I tell young people now we're in New York, they go, what? Because you're in these stupid little rooms auditioning. And it was great because you got to see an actor walk on stage and command the stage and, you know, what power they could give and then leave the stage. It was very wonderful. Well, because Hal Prince had Evita on it going already, that was the Broadway house that we were to audition. Now, the funny story about Evita, had a very high rake. And it was before they regulated rakes. They had to after that show because there
somebody
were a lot of
nearly
injuries.
Killed themselves, right?
Yeah, injuries with their, terrible injuries.
Just explain rake. It's the tilt of the stage.
It's the tilt of the stage. In fact, you know, there's a term in theater when we tell an actor to go upstage or downstage. That's because actually stages were tilted. And if you walked away from the audience, you were really literally walking up. And if you went towards, you were walking down. Now we flatten the stage and we raise the audience. But that term is still used. So, but in this particular show, they had a real rake. And I didn't know. And so I come to that audition in heels. And I'm not afraid of singing in front of the Hal Prince so much as I'm afraid I'm going to fall into the pit. You know? I sang Leonard Bernstein's I Can Cook Too. Mm-hmm. And I had to do a particular monologue that was never put in the piece, but George Firth had written it specially for the auditions. And it was very funny. Well, Hal came running up the aisles. He throws his glasses on top of his bald head, as he normally does. And to his assistant, who, if you're anyone who knows theater, Ruthie, that's what I'm talking about. And could you come back in 2 weeks or so and sing for Steve, because he's in Majorca? Sure. So I'm assuming I couldn't tell anybody there was a possibility I might have a show, because what if Steven saw and I didn't like me? Well, 2 weeks later, I go back to the Vita stage, and now it's my birthday. And I come pretty much the same kind of outfit, but in flats.
Yes.
And had a fun time with Mr. Sondheim. Mm-hmm. People say, well, you know, he doesn't like kids. And I said, well, I'm not a kid. He said, yeah, but he's, you know. And yeah. He was delightful. He was warm. He was a great audience. He laughed at the jokes. Mm-hmm. He asked me how high I sang. At those days, I could sing a high C, so I hang in high C. We laughed. He said, great. He says, I still have one more song I haven't written for Mary Flynn. I said, and that's nice. He said, well, I'll see you first day of rehearsal.
Oh, my God.
And so I walk out of the theater completely over my head.
Right.
You know, I'm walking home, and I go, oh, my God, I just got a Broadway show for my birthday. Walking down a little bit longer, Stephen Sondheim's writing me a song. And it was Now You Know.
Oh, my God.
Now, he's writing a song for
no,
show.
No, I understand.
But years later, when you hear Steve interviewed about something, he says he really likes to get to know
the person who's going to sing it. That's
because
right.
It gets the cadence of their voice and the quality in how they speak determines how they do it. And so in a way, he really sort of did.
That's right, exactly.
When you hear Now You Know, oh yeah, that's an Ann Morrison.
Yeah.
Now You Know, life is grounded. Well, Now You Know, big surprise. I mean, it's like, So, yeah, and it's kind of how the history of
that's
it.
That's a great story.
They put it in Sondheim, and Sondheim gave it to one of the younger ladies to do it in the show, and I think they split up part of it But when they the director said, oh no, we got the original Mary Moore here, he got us an old damn number. You know, so that the fun part is though that in this particular show, Merrily did not do well. It was considered in some circles a flop, although in other circles it was just ahead of its time.
Yeah.
And they still kept working on it. And then in some of the carnations that happened later, Steve started digging with some of those lyrics. So there, I get the script, and it's go, oh, I didn't sing that. But I always, every time I do Meryl, when I do Now You Know, I want to keep finding new ways of doing it. Mm-hmm. So, well, then let's just stretch myself, and let's learn these, not a lot, but they're just little things that are a little bit different.
Yeah, okay. Still, it's... I mean, you've done it so much that it must take some concentration
every time to get to that number.
That's right.
And I told them, if worst case scenario is, I'm just going to sing the song I've always sang.
Right.
Before I continue Annie's interview, I am going to play you Annie Morrison singing Now You Know, just as she sang it in the original production of Stephen Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along.
Right, now you know, life is crummy, well now you know. Okay, big surprise, people love you and tell you lies. Bricks can fall out of clear blue skies. Put your dimple down, now you know. Okay, there you go, learn to live with it, now you know. It's called flowers wilt, it's called apples rot. It's called thieves get rich and saints get shot. It's called God don't answer prayers a lot. Okay, now you know. Okay, now you know. Now forget it, don't fall apart at the seams. It's called letting go. Called what your choice is called, count to ten. It's called burn your bridges, start again. You should burn them every now and then, or you'll never grow. Because now you grow, that's the killer, is now you grow. You're right, nothing's fair, and it's all a plot. Tomorrow doesn't look so hot, right? You better look at what you got. Over here, hello.
So it's Sondheim on Sondheim, and it opened last week.
It opened, yeah. We opened on March 12th.
Right.
And we run through April 10th.
Okay.
So it's a nice little stint. You're going to see Larry Alexander,
which is a great thing.
And Eric Davis, who is the artistic director, is in the show this year. Chris Crawford to come in and direct was brilliant. He was last seen in there, Peter and the Starcatcher, as Black Stash. Funny, brilliant man.
And it's in Freefall.
Freefall in St. Pete, which is on Central Avenue between 60th and 61st. It's really easy to get there.
Yeah. They do great work at Freefall.
Oh, it's one of my favorite theaters
right
there.
Right.
In fact, a couple of people came over the bridge to see the show, said, oh, I think I want to get season tickets here. Mm-hmm. And we're now seeing more and more people go over the bridge. There was this kind of a separation between Sarasota and St. Pete, which is ridiculous.
Yes.
I can understand people have a fear of driving over the bridge, but you can get a buddy. Let me just address a couple things about Sondheim and Sondheim I want you to keep an eye on.
Yeah, yeah.
For instance, when I saw a video of the preview that was done in New York, I was highly disappointed. They missed so many points. Sondheim would say something very sensitive and beautiful, and then they would not punctuate it, but they would do the song that was supposed to be an example of it and make a mockery of it in a way. Here's an example. He just got done saying that finally at 60 he fell in love for the first time and understood what happiness was. And the song after that is from Passion Happiness, which is usually a two-character number. And it's spread out among all eight actors. But what they did was one person would love, 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 and they push that person away, and the next one come in, push that person away, all the way through. So a one-joke thing ran through eight people, and it was like...
But it's the opposite of what he said.
Just got done, yes.
Right.
Well, Chris Crawford said, no. And I don't want to tell you, we have to see it, but he brings to the storytelling about, it's all eight people singing, but it's telling the story about relationships.
Oh.
It's just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a mockery, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful song to begin with. Why make a mockery of it? That's an example. The next example I want you to watch for is the video that you get is the video that's sent originally from the Broadway show. But behind people like Vanessa Williams or Tom Wilpat, they're just kind of this generic art colors, and that was about it. And good old Eric Davis, who's a whiz kid at video, went, But that doesn't continue the storytelling. So all those little sections he removed and put in stories about Sondheim again, still with pictures. For example, they do Franklin Shepard Inc. from Merrily Roll Along, which is a fabulous patter song about this. And Steve had just got done talking about how ironic that Merrily is about two friends, or many friends, but they all split up because of, part of it is because of artistic differences. And that's exactly what happened to Hal and Steve.
Oh, my God.
That was the show that happened to them. He just says that. And so we see Franklin Shepard Inc., which is foreseeing that. They freeze. Chris has them freeze. Out comes Larry Alexander and sings Good Thing Going. And behind him is Hal and Steve. And then all around it are pictures of all the shows that they did together. Follies and Pacific Overtures. And at the top is the three of us from the original Merrily.
Oh my God.
His little tip of the hat. And then it becomes a variant of the song is going, going, gone. They have a big picture of Steve and one's like, going.
Oh, no, yeah.
Go, you know, and they fade out, gone. And
oh,
that
my God.
Is, why didn't they think of that in Broadway?
Right. Why
it
didn't
just
they?
Continues the storytelling right. So beautifully in a wonderful, that's the beauty of things you're going to see when you come up to see.
Oh, wonderful, 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 wonderful. Okay, so do you want to talk about anything else that's going on for you these days?
I have, hopefully, might do some more theater. I know this summer, you know, before I go teaching, I teach for Broadway Theater Project, which has been going for like 28 years. It was started by Anne Reinking, a big, you know, yes. Fosse dancer.
Yeah.
And she started with her friend, this wonderful camp that was in Tampa, of all places. And she would bring in some high, wonderful, talented faculty mm-hmm. in dance, in acting, and in music, and then she would bring in all these guest stars, whether they were from Broadway theater, she'd always bring in casting directors, all kinds of things. So you would have a three-week intensive that was quite, and it was to try and learn to be a triple threat.
Wow.
You know, it has a great reputation. It's gone through morph and sings and morph and sings and morph and sings.
But it's still doing triple threat.
Still doing triple threat. And I've been on faculty for 5 years now and love it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a three-week intensive and get to see some of my old buds from Broadway come on down and good old casting director like Jay Bender
mm-hmm.
come down and really give them a workout and really give them a sense of what's to expect.
Wow.
And then she brings other fun people in too. So this past year it was a little bizarre because we went on a cruise ship and it just didn't work out. We thought we'd have our third week on the ship. We'd mm-hmm. be 2 weeks on land and the third week. And we just didn't, there wasn't any space for us to really, really have classes. So I think those kids got shortchanged a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was fun to be in a cruise ship, but
yeah.
It wasn't. So we're back on land again.
Mm-hmm.
Back on land. And with the possibility of maybe going to Germany the following year. Germany is the third country in the world that's a musical theater fanatics.
You're kidding.
Yeah. It's the United States, England, and Germany.
Wow.
And so one of the guys said, yeah, he was one of our teachers, and mm-hmm. it would be delightful to have the cat, all of you
yeah,
come
yeah,
over
yeah.
And really give the Germans what it's like to be in Broadway. So,
all right, so do you want to...
So that's going on. And then I don't know what's happening for, you know, my life is, oh,
yes.
Let's see what happens next.
Yeah.
I am right now teaching Kaleidoscope Theater, which is a musical theater program I started
yeah.
for persons with developmental disabilities. And I'm in the midst of that now, so I go over the bridge and come back on Mondays and Tuesdays to work with this wonderful population of people who have no filters.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to bring regular theater people in to see, this is how we're supposed to be. This is what collaboration's about,
yes.
you know.
And this is what
delightful.
Freedom on stage is about.
Absolutely.
Right.
It's the love of my life.
Yeah.
And then my other love of my life is solo theater.
Yeah.
So, as you know, we just finished our second annual Sarah Solo Festival, yeah. which you know because you've been in both one and two.
I have.
And who knows, maybe in three.
Yeah, that's right.
You know? And I think it's growing. My only disappointment of this past year was I had some really lovely people from out of town and everybody gravitated to our locals, which is great news,
yeah.
that our locals got supported. But I got some wonderful people, didn't get to see some beautiful people. And that's just because we haven't been around,
yeah.
you know. Give us about 5 years and then they'll come and see everything.
You have given virtually your entire life to pretty much anything creative. And I wonder if you would just think for a minute and say what that's like for you to have dedicated a life to this kind of work.
It's just so... Part of what I am that I don't know how to really address it, except that I was very lucky to have the parents that I had. College professors, but they were Renaissance people. My mom was a visual artist. She was a modern dancer. She was a choreographer. She was a playwright. She was a designer of hats. She was a designer of plates. She wrote poetry. She wrote plays. My mom and dad collaborated. That's all I knew was collaboration. I didn't know about competition. Mm-hmm. They wrote 3 ballets, 1 opera, 3 musicals, art songs. I'd come home and my mom would be on the ladder pounding something. My dad would be in the kitchen cooking, you know, and vice versa. You didn't know, you know, and they were, so I just, they did everything. They created theater together. They created a company, you know, for the summertime where a lot of the Goodman students from Chicago would go up to Lake Geneva, Wisconsin to do things. And so that was just my role models. So when I went off to New York, because everybody told me that's what I was so talented I needed to do, I felt so unimpressed and didn't feel like I was where I belonged. There was just, it's just a universe I didn't understand. Mm-hmm. It felt so competitive and I didn't know what the problem was.
Right.
I went out to Los Angeles thinking that I needed to get television credits to work back in New York, and that wasn't it. And it wasn't until I was out there, though, that I started working with people with the National Dyslexia Research Foundation, because I'm dyslexic, and learning different children, and working with men who were dealing with their HIV status, and all kinds of things that I realized that life is, if it's simpler, it's larger. And that's kind of what my folks were about, theater, doing theater with a purpose. So, and it wasn't, I think I've told you this before, and I'll repeat it again. When my son said, Mommy, why is it when people say what they're going to be when they grow up, they never are? Really, really honestly did change my life. And so I didn't go back to New York. I came to Sarasota and was only going to be here a couple years until I realized that this community really let me do all the things that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
In a small way, but also extremely large.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
And
so you could be the person that you are.
Yeah, I could be the person that I am. And because of that, I love watching creativity in the others. And if mm-hmm. I can be of any assistance to get you to feel that you're alive in what you do, then that's a life worth living for me.
Yes, and I can speak for how you do it, because you've done it for me.
Oh, thank
over
you.
And over again.
Well, we ain't done, girl.
No, we ain't. That's wonderful, Annie. Thank you very much,
most
Annie
welcome.
Morrison.
So there you have the irrepressible, multi-talented Annie Morrison. And again, as I said in the beginning of the show, the support of one's family for who one actually is invaluable to the becoming of who one is. And you hear it in Annie. You hear that her entire family colluded to support each other in their interest in, attraction to, creation of a variety of arts. That they taught her to collaborate, not to compete. And of course, as she says, this has made it difficult for her in a world that is so based on competition, but still she's been able to find people who want to collaborate with her. And who wouldn't want to collaborate with this continually talented, continually producing, continually evolving spirit that is Annie Morrison? And I want to go out on a cut from an album that she gave me. This is Annie singing Lullaby of Broadway. And before I do that, let me say that I hope you got something that you can use from this show. Something that amused you, entertained you, interested you, something that stimulated you or inspired you to look into yourself, to look into your history and see whether you got supported for everything that you were. I hope you heard something that brings you back, because next week I will be here, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too. You're here, Annie Morrison singing Lullaby of Broadway.
Come on along and listen. listen to a lullaby of Broadway. Hip hooray and ballyhoo, a lullaby of Broadway. The rumble of a subway train, the rattle of the taxis, daffodils who entertain at Edlow's and Maxie's. When a Broadway baby says goodnight, it's early in the morning, and at babies don't sleep tight until the dawn. A lullaby of Broadway. The band begins to go to town, and everyone goes crazy. You rock goodbye your baby round till everything gets hazy. Hush-a-bye, I'll buy you this and that to hear a daddy saying. And baby goes home to her flat to sleep all day.
I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. On ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going.
play, it's a tremendous amount of courage to do, because you're very vulnerable. You're the only one up there.
Right.
And you're playing these people. So it's a much more tender, vulnerable art form.
Exposed.
You're exposed, mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.